Her lecture at the university went off extremely well. Ryan was a good speaker, and she knew her subject intimately. She held them fascinated with her account of the opening of the tomb of Queen Lostris and of the subsequent discovery of the scrolls. Many of her audience had read the book, and during question time they pestered her to know how much of it was the truth. She had to tread very carefully here, so as not to deal too harshly with the author. Afterwards, Professor Dixon took Ryan and Georgina to dinner. He was delighted with her success, and ordered the most expensive bottle of claret on the wine list to celebrate. He was only mildly disconcerted when she refused a glass of it. "Oh, dear me, I forgot that you were a Muslim," he apologized. "A Copt," she corrected him, "and it's not on religious grounds. I just don't like the taste." "Don't worry," Georgina counselled him. "I don't have the same odd compulsion to masochism as my daughter. She must get it from her father's side. I'll give you a hand to finish the good stuff." Under the benign influence of the claret, the professor became expansive and entertained them with the accounts of the archaeological digs he had been on over the decades. It was only over the coffee that he turned to Royan. "Goodness me, I almost forgot to tell you. I have arranged for you to visit the museum at Quentin Park any afternoon this week. Just ring Mrs. Street the day before, and she'll be waiting to let you in. She's Nicholas's PA." Royan remembered the way to Quentin Park from when Georgina had driven them out to the chute. But now she was alone in the Land Rover. The massive main gates to the estate were made of ornate cast iron. A little further on, the road divided, and a cluster of road signs pointed the way to the various destinations. Quentin Hall, private, estate office, and museum. The road to the museum curved through the deer park, where herds of fallow deer grazed under the winter bare oaks. Through the misty landscape she had glimpses of the big house. According to the guidebook that the prof had given her, Sir Christopher Wren had designed the house in 1693, and the master landscapist Capability Brown had created the gardens 60 years later. The results were perfection. The museum was set in a grove of copper beech trees, half a mile beyond the house. It was a sprawling building that had obviously been added to more than once over the years. Mrs. Street was waiting for her at the side door and introduced herself as she let Royan in. She was middle-aged, grey-haired and self-assured. "I was at your lecture on Monday evening. Fascinating. I have a guidebook for you, but you will find the exhibits well catalogued and described. I've spent almost 20 years at the job. There are no other visitors today. You will have the place to yourself. You must just wander around and please yourself. I shall not leave until 5 this evening, so you have all afternoon. If I can help you in any way, my office is at the end of the passage. Please don't hesitate." From the first moment that Royan walked into the display of African mammals, she was enthralled. The primate room housed a complete collection of every single species of ape and monkey from the continent, from the great silver-backed male gorilla to the delicate colobus in his long flowing mantle of black and white fur. They were all represented. Although some of the exhibits were over 100 years old, they were beautifully preserved and presented, set in painted dioramas of their natural habitat. It was obvious that the museum must employ a staff of skilled artists and taxidermists. She could guess what this must have cost. Wryly, she decided that the $5 million from the sale of the plundered frieze had been well spent. She went through to the antelope room and stared around her in wonder at the magnificent beasts preserved here. She stopped before a diorama of a family group of the giant sable antelope of the now extinct Angolan variety, Hippotragus niger variani. While she admired the jet-black and snowy-chested bull with his long, back-swept horns, she mourned his death at the hand of one of the Quentin Harper family. Then she checked herself. Without the strange dedication and passion of the hunter-collector who had killed him, future generations might never have been able to look upon this regal presence. She passed on into the next hall, which was given over to displays of the African elephant, and paused in the centre of the room before a pair of ivory tusks so large that she could not believe that they had ever been carried by a living animal. They seemed more like the marble columns of some Hellenic temple to Diana the goddess of the chase. She stooped to read the printed catalogue card. Tusks of the African elephant Loxodonta africana, shot in the Lado enclave in 1899 by Sir Jonathan Quentin Harper. Left tusk, £289, right tusk, £301. Length of larger tusk, 11 feet 4 inches, girth, 32 inches. The largest pair of tusks ever taken by a European hunter. They stood twice as high as she was tall, and they were half as thick again as her waist. As she passed on into the Egyptian room, she marvelled at the size and strength of the creature that had carried them. She came up short as her eyes fell upon the figure in the centre of the room. It was a 15-foot-high figure of Ramesses II, depicted as the god Osiris in polished red granite. The god emperor strode out on muscular legs, wearing only sandals on his feet and a short kilt. In his left hand he carried the remains of a war bow, with both the upper and lower limbs of the weapon broken off. This was the only damage that the statue had suffered in all those thousands of years. The rest of it was perfect. The plinth even bore the marks of the mason's chisel. In his right fist, Pharaoh carried a seal embossed with his royal cartouche. Upon his magic head, he wore the tall double crown of the upper and lower kingdoms. His expression was calm and enigmatic. Rayan recognized the statue instantly, for its twin stood in the grand hall of the Cairo Museum. She passed it every day on her way to work. She felt anger rising in her. This was one of the major treasures of her very Egypt. It had been plundered and stolen from one of her country's sacred sites. It did not belong here. It belonged on the banks of the great river Nile. She felt herself shaking with the strength of her emotion as she went forward to examine the statue more closely and to read the hieroglyphic inscription on the base. The royal cartouche stood out in the centre of the arrogant warning. I am the divine Ramesses, master of 10,000 chariots. Fear me, O you enemies of Egypt. Rayan had not read the translation aloud. It was a soft, deep voice close behind her that spoke, startling her. She had not heard anyone approaching. She spun round to find him standing close enough to touch. His hands were thrust into the pockets of a shapeless blue cardigan. There was a hole in one elbow. He wore faded denim jeans over well-worn but monogrammed velvet carpet slippers, the type of genteel shabbiness that certain Englishmen often cultivate, for it would never do to seem too concerned with one's appearance. Sorry, didn't mean to startle you. He smiled a lazy smile of apology, and his teeth were very white but slightly crooked. Suddenly his expression changed as he recognized her. Oh, it's you. She should have been flattered that he remembered her from so fleeting a contact, but there was that flash of something in his eyes again that offended her. Nevertheless, she could not refuse the hand he offered her. Nick Quentin Harper, he introduced himself. You must be Percival Dixon's old student. I think I saw you at the shoot last Thursday. Weren't you beating for us? His manner was friendly and forthright, so she felt her hackles subsiding as she responded. Yes, I am Royan Alcimer. I think you knew my husband, Duryed Alcimer. Duryed, of course I know him. Grand old fellow. We spent a lot of time in the desert together. One of the very best. How is he? He's dead. She had not meant it to sound so bald and heartless. But then there was no other reply she could think of. I am so terribly sorry. I didn't know. When and how did it happen? Very recently, 3 weeks ago, he was murdered. Oh, my God! She saw the sympathy in his eyes, and she remembered that he also had suffered. I telephoned him in Cairo, not more than 4 months ago. He was his old charming self. Have they found the person who did it? She shook her head and looked around the hall to avoid having to face him, and let him see that her eyes were wet. You have an extraordinary collection here. He accepted the change of subject at once. Thanks mostly to my grandfather. He was on the staff of Evelyn Baring. Overbearing, as his numerous enemies called him. He was the British man in Cairo during... She cut him short. Yes, I have heard of Evelyn Baring, the first Earl of Cromer, British Consul General of Egypt from 1883 to 1907. With his plenipotentiary powers, he was the unchallenged dictator of my country for all that period. Numerous enemies, as you say. Nicholas's eyes narrowed slightly. Percival warned me you were one of his best students. He didn't, however, warn me of your strong nationalistic feelings. It's clear that you didn't need me to translate the Ramesses inscription for you. My own father was on the staff of Gamal Abdel Nasser, she murmured. Nasser was the man who had toppled the puppet King Farouk and finally broken the British power in Egypt. As president, he had nationalized the Suez Canal in the face of British outrage. Ha! He chuckled. Different sides of the track. But things have changed. I hope we won't have to be enemies. Not at all, she agreed. Duryed held you in the highest esteem. As I did him. He changed the subject again. We are very proud of our collection of royal ushabti, examples from the tomb of every pharaoh from the Old Kingdom onwards, right up to the last of the Ptolemies. Please let me show it to you. She followed him to the huge display case that occupied one complete wall of the hall. It was lined with shelf after shelf of the doll-like figures which had been placed in the tombs to act as servants and slaves for the dead kings in the shadow world. With his own key, Nicholas opened the glazed doors of the case and reached up to bring down the most interesting of the exhibits. This is the Ashabti of Maya, who served under three pharaohs, Tutankhamun, Ay, and Horemheb. It is from the tomb of Ay, who died in 1343 BC. He handed the doll to her, and she read aloud the 3,000-year-old hieroglyphics as easily as though they had been the headlines of that morning's newspaper. I am Maya, treasurer of the two kingdoms. I will answer for the divine pharaoh Ay. May he live forever. She spoke in Arabic to test him, and his reply in the same language was fluent and colloquial. It seems that Percival Dixon told me the truth. You must have been an exceptional student. Engrossed now in their common interest, speaking alternately Arabic and English, the initial sharp prickles of antagonism between them were dulled. They moved slowly round the hall, lingering before each display case to handle and examine minutely each object that it contained. It was as though they were transported back over the millennia. Hours and days seemed of no consequence in the face of such antiquity, and so it startled both of them when Mrs. Street returned to interrupt them. "I'm off now, Sir Nicholas. Can I leave it to you to lock up and set the alarm? The security guards are on duty already." "Oh, what time is it?" Nicholas answered his own question by glancing at the stainless steel Rolex Submariner on his wrist. 5:40 already. What on earth happened to the day?" He sighed theatrically. "Well, off you go, Mrs. Street. Sorry we kept you so long." "Don't forget to set the alarm," she warned him, and then to Ryan. "He can be so absent-minded when he is off on one of his hobby horses." Her fondness towards her employer was obviously that of an indulgent aunt. "You've given me enough orders for one day. Off you go," Nicholas grinned as he turned back to Ryan. "Can't let you go without showing you something that Duryed was in on with me. Can you stay for a few minutes longer?" She nodded, and he reached out as if to take her arm, and then dropped his hand. In the Arab world it is insulting to touch a woman, even in such a casual manner. She was aware of the courtesy, and she warmed to his good manners and easy style a little more. He led her out of the exhibition halls through a door marked Private Staff Only and down a long corridor to the room at the end.